This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Family separation is still devastating the lives of children.
There are about 5.5 million children who have at least one undocumented parent. But we also know that the majority of those children, 4.5 million, are children who are U.S. citizens. That means that most of them were born here and have a legal status here. And these experiences of fear and anxiety and trauma really impact their lives, not only personally, but, you know, academically, emotionally, physically. Their lives are not protected in the ways that we think that we protect children. And so many of them don't only have the fear about deportation, but go through the experience of having a parent deported.
That's Sylvia Rodriguez-Vega. Her book, Drawing Deportation, is about how family separation is traumatizing children and how art is helping them to heal. Then, a graphic book told through the words of American spiritual teacher Ram Dass. We talk with Amy Butens about You Are the Universe. Ram Dass maps the journey. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Many Americans were profoundly shocked at the images of young children held in cages at the southern border when former President Trump imposed his family separation policy. But the U.S. has been separating immigrant families for long before Trump, and continues to do so under Biden. It's not just happening at the border. Every day, families are being ripped apart as our cruel and dysfunctional immigration system deports parents, leaving traumatized children behind. Just the constant fear of deportation is enough to damage the health and well-being of children. My guest, Sylvia Rodriguez-Vega, explores the trauma of immigrant children and innovative programs using art to deal with the trauma. Her book, Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children, draws on 10 years of work with those children, helping them express their fears and hopes through art and theater. It shows the healing power of art, but also calls for systemic change to stop traumatizing kids in the first place. Sylvia Rodriguez-Vega, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
So this book, Drawing Deportation, is wrenching, it's hopeful, and it's powerful. You yourself were undocumented as a child. So tell us a little bit about your own experience and how that led to this book.
Yeah, this is a book that is very close to home for me. I was a child who was born in Mexico and migrated with my family at the age of 3 to Arizona. And I grew up not really knowing the impact of our immigration status on our lives until I became a little bit older and got to understand the ways that my family's liberty to move and travel and work and drive were all restricted because of immigration. And so going into college, it really became more real for me because then I was presented with challenges around funding my education and things like that. But throughout this entire time, it was incredibly instrumental for me to be part of a theater group that I was in. And in this theater group, I got to really think about the ways that not only laws, but things like poverty and violence and many other things were impacting my family, my community, my friends, my school. And this became a very formative experience for me that later in life I continued to come back to. And so you see that here in the book where I'm showing art and theater and drawings and journal entries. And this all comes from my own experience navigating immigration policies, but using art to do so.
Before we get to the art, though, let's talk a little bit about history. The family separation policies of Trump shocked the consciences of many Americans. But you write that the practice of family separation as a tactic of control isn't new. It's a very American practice, you write, that developed across time during many presidential administrations, really even going quite way back to colonial times. So talk a little bit about that history that underlays current policy.
Yeah, I mean, there are some wonderful writers like Laura Briggs who publish work about the historical ways that children have been used as pawns in social control in the United States. And if we think, for example, during the time of colonization and settler colonialism in these terms, you know, basically when Native American children were taken from their families and forcibly placed on trains that would take them to schools that were meant to Americanize them by force, which meant prohibiting them from having their language, their practices, their clothing, their names, their hair, and completely giving them new identities and new ways of being. And this was very traumatic and horrible for these children and families. And we see the legacy of that just, you know, a couple of years ago, many of the bodies of children were found around boarding schools. Many of the children were never reunited with their families and with their communities. And so that's one of the examples that I write about also in the book. And thinking about enslavement and, you know, Black children thought of as property and sold to white families and other states. And so that separation between families also very painful. And it's something that I think we don't think about, but children are often used as a way of controlling adults. And so just this is an example of how immigration systems like the zero tolerance policy, that the goal was to create suffering and to separate children from their families so that the families would not even consider making the journey again to the United States, or that people back in Central America would not even plan a trip or a journey north to attempt to get into the United States and seek asylum. And so these are ways that children are sadly impacted. And it's a terrible thing. And I think that unless we think about it and come to terms with it and acknowledge the historical lineage of family separation, we are doomed to repeat it again and again.
Which, in fact, we have. You know, the Obama administration, I remember, but I think many people are not aware of this. I remember how people in the immigrant rights community called him the deporter in chief. And I remember him promising that only the worst criminals among immigrants would be deported. But my own next door neighbors had someone who was not a worst criminal by any means, was deported for a traffic violation back to Mexico. So how did Obama set the stage for Trump? And then how did Trump set the stage for Biden?
Yeah, this is a very important part of the narrative of immigration policy in the last decade. Obama, it did some very important things when it came to immigration policy, like passing deferred action for childhood arrivals, this executive action that would grant some sort of temporary status to thousands of young people. And at the same time, he made a campaign around promises of passing immigration reform within the first 100 days of his presidency. And that didn't happen. And what folks didn't know was going to happen was that, in fact, he was to become the president with the most deportations before him. And so I think that a lot of the narratives around the Obama administration failed to mention that he created the blueprint for the immigration process, or the immigration machinery, as it's called, that Trump used and then took to another level. And so, you know, we talk about how horrible it was that Trump caged children And in fact, that also happened during the Obama administration. And like you said, when you're talking about your neighbor, I'm afraid that many of us have neighbors like that in family members and students and teachers and people in our workplaces who, just by having any interaction with law enforcement, are detained and deported through policies like 287G agreements, which essentially made local law enforcement immigration officers. And that meant that if you were a victim of a crime, if something happened, if you called for help, if your windshield wiper wasn't wiping correctly or the lights weren't working on your car and you got pulled over, then that would be an automatic way for you to be deported or detained. And so this is the legacy around immigration that isn't thought about. And we knew, to answer your second question, we knew that Biden's policies might resemble Obama's because he was part of that administration as well. But what was completely unexpected was that Biden would actually resemble Trump's policies. He critiqued Trump around many of the things that happened during that administration. And now we're seeing similar things happen, and even conversations about reopening many of these detention centers that he specifically critiqued and called to question and said that we're not safe spaces. And so we see promises being broken again. And of course, many people suffering, as we saw recently with the fire that killed many people in Juarez, Mexico, that is part of responsibility of the United States, because we've made Mexico an extension of the U.S. border, where we are tasking them with patrolling so that people from other countries will not be able to come. And that's just one example. There are many examples that we can talk about when it comes to the Biden administration and their attitude and policies towards asylum seekers specifically.
And talking about the breaking of families, you know, the separation of families, I think people don't realize, you know, they think about separating families at the border, which is horrendous enough, but often there are children who are born here, are therefore U.S. citizens, so that when these deportations happen, families are still being separated.
Correct. And I think the book really takes account of the experiences and lives of these families. There are about 5.5 million children who have at least one undocumented parent. But we also know that the majority of those children, 4.5 million, are children who are U.S. citizens. That means that most of them were born here and have legal status here and won't be leaving anytime soon. And so these experiences of fear and anxiety and trauma really impact their lives, not only personally, but, you know, academically, emotionally, physically. Their lives are not protected in the ways that we think that we protect children. And so many of them don't only have the fear about deportation, but go through the experience of having a parent deported. And that obviously has a long line of effects on a child that really hinder their ability to focus at school, to communicate, to share their feelings, and just to be healthy children, which will impact the ways that they transition into adulthood, making it an issue for all of us, I think. I think that's something that we all should think about. What happens when a large portion of our population has experienced these terrible things that, unfortunately, I think it's a tough time for children to grow up in our society.
Yeah, and add to this then, obviously, the attitudes. I mean, there's a whole criminalization of immigration. There's a language of threat and exclusion. You talk about the brown threat and the Latino threat, you know, the notion of invasions. How do the children perceive how they are viewed by American society? And how do they construct those who spout these kinds of racist tropes?
Yeah, I think it's a huge disconnect because children are being taught things like respect and kindness, and the US is the land of opportunity and the land of freedom, and it's a nation of immigrants, and all of these things that we all grow up on. And at the same time, when you turn on the television, the radio, you look at a newspaper, you look at your phone and see anything on social media, you see the ways that presidential candidates like Trump called immigrant children criminals, future criminals, animals, rapists, things that were just terrible. And so children really are confused about why their families are being treated this way. And so the media plays a huge role in that, because during the time when I was working with children in California, it was during the election. So constantly there were things on the news about the border and who was going to pay for it and all of the candidates and their stance on immigration. And that really impacted children. They constantly talked about it. They wanted to process it. They wanted to respond. They wanted to fight back. They didn't want their families to be thought of in these terrible ways. And they were ready to respond. But I think children often don't have an outlet to do so. And using art was one of the ways that they felt some sort of control and ability to respond and be heard.
You use the word healing a lot in this book, Sylvia Rodriguez Vega, in this book, Drawing Deportation. You talk about the praxis of healing. You reference Paulo Freire, who, you know, was a great theorist of popular education. Talk about healing. Talk about the notion of praxis that you use with reference to your work with these children.
Everything we've talked about until this point, the policies, the effects of them, the history, I think all of these things are terrible for children. They take away their ability to be children and adultifies them too soon, which has negative consequences. And worrying constantly about the safety of your family creates stress that becomes toxic and changes the chemistry of your brain and your body. And all of these things are terrible for our health and mentally, physically, emotionally. So it was essential for me to include moments of reflection, to be able to process, to be able to think about this and talk about it. But I think what I found was that it wasn't just about the final drawing that kids did or the final performance that we performed in front of the whole school. It was every single practice, every single draft, everything that they were creating was a way of coping. And with that coping came moments of healing and an ability to let out some of the frustration, the anger, the sadness, the grief that many children carry with them every day. And so this, you know, is something that I think art affords them. The process of creating was a way of them externalizing what they were feeling. And I think that the work of Paulo Freire really helps us think about ways of creating dialogue with people about their lives. And so these were the techniques that I used. I wanted them to watch the news. And the next day I asked them, what was the most important news story that you read or heard? And then we would talk about that. And then we'd create a skit about that. And all of that was really powerful. I think people ask often, how hard was it to do this project, to write this book? And it was definitely challenging, but I think it was also beautiful and it was hopeful and it was powerful because I got to see children use their imagination to create solutions to these problems. And that to me was healing for me as well, but I also think it was healing for them.
You know, what struck me also when you write in the book that children can reimagine reality in a way that adults can't or maybe don't. And one of those ways was to imagine an alternate reality in which their oppressors like Joe Arpaio in New Mexico or Donald Trump would, well, Donald Trump, I think, actually had a different way of dealing with Donald Trump, which we'll get to in a minute. But I was struck by drawings of Joe Arpaio shaking hands with a Mexican, with expressions of love, of solidarity. You know, Joe Arpaio, the sheriff who was responsible for some of the most draconian and racist anti-immigrant policies in New Mexico. Of course, now they're being trumped by people like, you know, the governor of Texas and governors of Texas and Florida. But he was the first, at least in our modern world. So talk about how children used art and used theater to create the world they wanted to see.
Yeah. You know, I just want to add one correction, that Sheriff Joe Arpaio was the sheriff for many, many years of Maricopa County in Arizona.
Arizona, not New Mexico. Thank you for that. Yes.
And the history there, I argue in the book, was that Arizona was the laboratory where a lot of these racist, anti-immigrant, painful policies were birthed and practiced and experimented with. And these policies quickly spread across the U.S., not only with Trump, which then became a nationwide Arizona, but even before then. And so I'll just tell this quick story of how this book actually came to be, was that I was working with children at a community center in Arizona. And we were working on a plan for a mural. And I asked the kids who were ages like 5 through 17 years old. And I said, well, we're going to make a mural, but what do you all want a mural to be about? And one of the kids said, can we make a mural about peace? And I replied, yeah, peace sounds lovely. Can you tell me, what does peace look like? And this kid responded, he was 9 years old, and he said, peace looks like Sheriff Joe Arpaio shaking hands with a Mexican. And that is an image that we couldn't even imagine, because every single day, Sheriff Joe Arpaio would conduct his own media press conferences to tell everyone where these raids were going to happen, what he was doing. He was recruiting volunteer sheriffs to patrol Home Depots and just terrible things every single day. It was about creating fear and instilling that in immigrant people. And so for a child to have this vision that if Sheriff Joe Arpaio were to shake hands with a Mexican, that would symbolize peace, was incredibly profound. Many of the kids there experienced those immigration raids in their communities, and often they'd come into the center telling me that they can't find their uncle who went to get their car out of being impounded, or that their dad had been taken in one of the raids. And I saw a lot of that suffering. And I saw this mural as an opportunity for them to visualize an alternative. And unfortunately, we weren't able to create that mural because it was controversial. But I asked kids, can you do a drawing or a poem or a letter? Why does this mural matter to you? Why is this mural important? And that day I walked out with about 50 to 60 drawings of children who were describing the most painful but also important images that I knew many people needed to see. And unfortunately, that just became more pressing when Trump came into office. But that is what led to this 15-year commitment that started in 2008, when I had the idea of writing a book about what children were experiencing. And 15 years later, here I am with this book in my hand and finally feeling like the time has come for people to see the consequences of these policies and to do something to change the outcome of what we're going to do and what we're doing now currently at the border, which is also very destructive to people and children specifically.
Yes. Well, let's talk about the other side of the coin. You know, we talked about drawings of peace and reconciliation. When it came to Trump, there was a lot of fantasizing about assassinating Trump. What was your reaction to that? What was the children's reaction to that? How did you deconstruct these fantasies of murder?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really hard part to write because every time it came up, it was kids saying, like, we just need to remove Trump. Like, if he's not there, then all of these problems will disappear and our families will be safe and nothing bad will happen. And so in their skits, they often would say, like, okay, we're going to make him not be the president, or Hillary's going to be the president instead of him. And over time, these ideas of removing Trump became about, let's get the military to take him out. Let's get police to go after him, or snipers and things like that. And so in the moment, it was comedy and light. But when I looked at every single time that it was mentioned, I started to see a pattern that was about children reflecting back, mirroring back the dehumanization, the pain, the fear, and the ways that losing a parent as a child means death. When you're a child and you depend on your parent for survival, and all of a sudden they disappear, they're taken away, that creates a sense of danger in your life and can very well lead to death. And so for children, they reflected this. And I argue that it was a way of them having some sort of control to speak back. There was this sense of justice that they wanted. They wanted him to be responsible for the horrible things that he was saying and planning. And so this was one of the ways. They also had other alternatives, like protesting. There's a scene where children talk to their teacher and ask the teacher for help because they're being bullied at school for being immigrants. And then they find out that the teacher has a red MAGA hat and that she's a Trump supporter. And so then they feel like they have to take matters into their own hands. And they go to a rally on the border and they bring all of these signs and start asking Trump, why do you hate us? Why don't you like us? You're married to an immigrant. Why do you do this to us? And other things. And so generally they had so many ideas and they wanted to discuss them and wanted to fight back. But definitely ideas of just completely removing, eliminating Trump were present. And I think it resembles the ways that Trump tried to kill and eliminate immigrant children by separating them from their families. Children as young as toddlers and babies were separated from their families. And we know that children have died on the border trying to get to the U.S., drowning, dying of thirst. This is a very real situation where many people have died because of these immigration policies.
You come to the conclusion, I mean, after all of this, clearly there is some healing going on. Clearly, you can see so vividly how art provides a way for children to feel empowered in their own lives. And yet, you also say that while art is indispensable, and I'd like you to say why it is indispensable, you also say that the resilience it provides is not an antidote to the harm that is caused. So tell us why art is indispensable, but not enough.
Art is a human right. Art is a language and a way of existing and a way of just being a human. And I think that because of that, children especially need art, particularly children who are vulnerable and go through difficulties in life. Art is a tool of power for them and a way of thinking through some really tough things. And unfortunately, we know that art isn't valued in our society, at least especially for Black and Brown children and immigrant children and poor children. They have very little opportunities to use art, to experience art, to see it, to feel it, and participate in it. And these are the children that I believe need it the most because of the ways that art can heal and provide an escape and provide a way of coping. And at the same time, I believe that the answer to these issues isn't just to put all children in art programs. I think that would be fabulous. But at the end of the day, this is a systemic issue. Immigration enforcement, immigration policies, immigration rhetoric are a system that functions, and this system needs to change. It's not the child who needs to change and all of a sudden respond in ways that are resilient and fighting back. I think that children should just be children. Children should just be protected and cared for and loved. And I think that we are not doing that currently. And one of the ways to do that is to change these policies. I think that there are many ways that this systemic issue of family separation should end and should stop having this effect on families through the separation of children from their parents. And for example, all of the children that have been separated from their parents at the border during Trump's zero tolerance policy in 2018 have not been reunited with their families. Many of those children, some of them have, and I think the Biden administration has taken it upon themselves to figure out a way to reunite those families, but many of them haven't. And I think that that is a one place that we should start. Also, there are many children that have migrated who are trying to reconnect and reunite with their parents who live in the U.S. or family members that live in the U.S. And I think that what we're seeing of people migrating is part of that. Families need to be reunited. And frankly, one of the reasons that so many people are coming to the U.S. is because of U.S. interventions in many of those countries where people are fleeing from. And so this is a systemic issue that goes beyond children, beyond art, beyond what is on the ballot sometimes. And I think we need to take responsibility to be able to change this, not just through voting, which I think is very powerful and needed, but also through laws and policy and knowledge, just knowing that this happened and knowing that it can continue to happen is a really great place to start.
And so is your book, is a great place to start. It really puts one into the minds and the hearts of these children who have been so assaulted by our system. And I want to thank you, Silvia Rodriguez-Vega, for writing Drawing Deportation and for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice. Next up, a graphic book told in the words of Ram Dass. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ram Dass was one of America's most loved spiritual teachers. His dedication to the service of others is what drew me to him, notably with his book, How Can I Help? But even before that book, he opened me and many others of my generation to a way of being that transcended social expectations with his book, Be Here Now. His message wasn't so much that of his Harvard colleague Tim Leary, turn on, tune in, and drop out, as it was tune in and love everybody. That's the message at the heart of a lovely new graphic book for teens and adults, You Are the Universe, Ram Dass Maps the Journey. Using Ram Dass's own words from writings and recordings, Amy Butens illustrated and co-edited the book with her twin sister and longtime collaborator, Julie Weinstein. Amy Butens, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be with you.
So there's a great picture of you and your sister with Ram Dass. So evidently you both knew him. Tell us a little bit about how did you get to know him and what was your work with him?
Well, I discovered Ram Dass maybe a little bit before 1996, came to him through the Grateful Dead. Jerry Garcia had mentioned him. I see the look in your face. But he was friends with all of them. And Ram Dass had written a beautiful eulogy for Jerry. And I don't know, it was just it wasn't a big deal in our life at that time. And I didn't actually know that he would be such an influence in our life later on. But I really appreciated learning about his teachings. We grew up in a very progressive, reformed Jewish family. And Ram Dass just was kind of a breath of fresh air. He introduced concepts to us like your true self and spirituality in a universal sense, and just some very basic universal spiritual truths about consciousness and who we are and how we evolve. And over time, eventually, Julie moved to New Mexico in 1996 and had first come to the ashram here. There's a Neem Karoli Baba ashram. Neem Karoli Baba was Ram Dass's real guru, his teacher in life. And there was an ashram here set up and established early on. So we came to the ashram at first and then just enjoyed the company and the community. And I think that was really transformative for both Julie and I. And then we just deepened into the community and Ram Dass's teachings. He became such a huge influence in our life. He inspired everything we do in death and dying work and our creative work, and even just brought me closer to Judaism. And we first met him, I think it was in maybe 2015 or something. That photo that you're referencing was from 2016. Ram Dass led up until his death retreats every year in Maui, and we were fortunate to go to several of those. And so that's where that photo was.
You know, it's so interesting, some of the things you've said here. I mean, I grew up in Reform Judaism as well. And the book that I read of his that really influenced my life was How Can I Help?, which is a book about service. I always felt that his philosophy, of course, he was Jewish as well, resonated very much with the whole idea of tikkun olam, that if you save one life, you save the world. So before we go into his early life and some of the other things in the book, talk about his notion of service.
Well, Ram Dass approached service from a very spiritual standpoint. He was a bhakti yogi, and he also practiced karma yoga. And service was a big part of his life. You mentioned How Can I Help? And one of the books that I really appreciated was called Still Here. And so in 1997, he had a stroke. And so the early part of his life was devoted to service, helping people by being an example. He really practiced and emulated how to work towards alleviating suffering without creating more suffering, and what it's like to work towards the alleviation of suffering without being attached to the outcome, and also how to serve with compassionate intentions. But after his stroke, he was really learning how to say, how can you help me at this, which was very hard for a helper. And so that was an interesting shift for him. And so one of the things that I most admire about Ram Dass and his approach to service was that he approached everything with love, and that's bhakti yoga. And his path of service, the service of love and devotion, which is karma yoga. And he did it as a way to honor his guru, which is called guru kripa. And that is devoting your practices and really your entire life and offering that up, making that an offering of love. You know, we can do that in today's sense without a guru or anything. We can remember loved ones or do something in somebody's honor. These are just different approaches to service, but really that was the crux of his life, is being of service. And he did that in a number of ways. He worked to help alleviate blindness across the world. He helped start an organization called the Seva Foundation. He worked with the Hanuman Foundation, which created a prison ashram project, and a number of other service projects, really up until his death. Even just his number one teaching was spreading his message of love and how we can work on ourselves as the ultimate act of service, because he really believed that we are the consciousness that will shift the transformation that's so needed in the world. This concept you're speaking of, tikkun olam, how we can heal the world is by healing ourselves and looking at our stuff, our nishagas, our baggage, our what makes us work and tick and operate in the world, and how to elevate that more consciously as an act of service that is transformative and so needed in the world right now.
So talk about his notion of love and how You know, I mean, of course, we've all heard this. We are all one. But he really explains that, I think, in a way that is very, just much more easily understandable to perhaps our Western culture.
I think it's a very challenging concept. And I think it often gets confused, too. And when he first received this teaching from his guru, his name is Neem Karoli Baba, and he's also called Maharaji, he said, "Maharaji, I can't love everyone." And Maharaji kept repeating it, "Ram Dass, love everyone." And he was telling him, if I could just read to you, in those early days of being with Maharaji, he would tell me repeatedly, "Ram Dass, I want you to love everybody and tell the truth." It was like he was telling me that the person I thought myself to be was changing. He was changing my insides. He came up to me nose to nose, looked me in the eye and said, "Give up anger. You tell the truth and you love everybody." At that time, I could only do that every now and then. We treat love and hate and the other emotions like they are all on the same level, but they're not. And I think what Ram Dass was downloading from Maharaji at the time was the information to see everyone as souls, to recognize his soul and to see others as souls so that he can love everyone. And the teaching is we move beyond roles and we recognize people as souls. We can reject the action, but not the person. And that is how we love everyone. And love is a very hard thing for us because we're so conditioned to put up boundaries and protections and operate from our woundedness. But when we go beyond that, we connect to something greater, which Ram Dass truly believed is love, which permeates every cell of our being. It's in everything. And we can access that by tapping into the energy that we are much more than our egos and our roles. We are souls, and we can recognize this love that exists in other people when we emulate that as well. It's a very challenging concept. He worked his entire life to do that. He said it took him more than 50 years to come to that place. And he did that with a meditation on loving awareness, which really became his core teaching in life, in the later stages of his life, where he just meditated on this concept of love and a loving awareness that he really saw as, if you want to use the word God, but that was what we are and what he recognized as this God-like concept that we are all capable of embodying and emulating.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with Amy Butens about the graphic book she illustrated and co-edited with her sister Julie Weinstein, You Are the Universe, Ram Dass Maps the Journey. Yes, and I mean, it's not particular to Hinduism or Buddhism or Christianity. All religions really do say that God is love. You know, people repeat that, but they don't really think about what that really means. And you mentioned roles. You know, he talks about the difference between roles and souls. Talk a little bit about his earlier life when he was still Richard Alpert and how much he was engaged with playing the roles that he felt were expected of him.
Yeah, one thing I really appreciate about Ram Dass, and I know you do as well, is that he talked so openly and really with a lot of humor and just honesty about where he came from and how he grew up so we could all learn from his experience. He was born into a wealthy Jewish family. He was encouraged to really embody this spacesuit. He talked about jokingly, you know, we're all born into a spacesuit. It's this form that we take, our parents, our guardians, society, puts expectations on us that we should be a certain way, that we fit into a certain role. And right around the time where he was in college, he was studying psychology and social sciences and really curious about kind of what makes us tick and the inner workings of the mind. He was teaching at Harvard. He had the good fortune to work with Timothy Leary. And back when LSD was legal as a psychedelic substance, he was exploring mystical experiences and what that has to offer as far as information relating to consciousness. And I think that really helped him step out of these roles, this role of Harvard professor, of cello player, of the good student, the good son, and really helped him move beyond this concept of prescribed roles that society so guides, you know, the evolution of our role in life.
It was a real struggle for him.
It was a real struggle. He lived within these expectations. And then one night he got the chance to try this substance, as a synthetic substance of the mushrooms. And he had a transformative experience. He saw himself, what is commonly classified as ego death, step out of these roles. He literally was sitting on the couch and he saw Ram Dass, if you will. At the time, it was Richard Alpert, leave his body. And he said goodbye to Harvard professor. He said goodbye to car collector, cello player, wealthy intellectual. And he literally saw this part of himself dissolve. And the next morning, when he went to teach his psychology classes, he could not put in words. He called it an ineffable experience and could not relate to the material that he was teaching because he had just transformed his whole understanding of what it means to be and do according to the roles that he had been told. And he knew there was much more to life at that time. And then he looked to the east. He wanted to understand, like you were saying, these universal truths regarding the maps of our consciousness, to help him understand how he had just transformed or witnessed this evolution of the self. And he went to the east to discover the maps. And he discovered Buddhism and he studied in that and did deep meditations and different types of meditation techniques. And then he eventually went to India and literally climbed a mountain. I love the metaphor of that too, to meet a personality that he didn't know at the time, but had the information of what it really meant to transform these roles and to live fully in your soul and from that place of love.
And he met his guru. He was actually, as he talks about in this book, You Are the Universe, Ram Dass Maps the Journey. And I'm talking with the co-author, Amy Buten. She wrote the book with her twin sister, Julie Weinstein. He was not in a good mood. He was not sure he was in the right place at all. Tell us a story of him meeting Neem Karoli Baba?
Yep, Neem Karoli Baba. You got it perfect. He went begrudgingly. He was exhausted. He was angry. He was following this guy up this mountain. He was barefoot. He did not want to be there. And he goes up this mountain, meets this guru. He was totally put off by all these devotees around him. He thought it was, you know, holy schlock wearing white. And he just didn't connect or identify with it. Well, the night before, Ram Dass had met his guru. He had been sleeping outside and got up in the middle of the night and went to the bathroom. And he was looking up the stars, thinking about his mother who had just died 6 months earlier. She died of spleen cancer. And all of a sudden, Ram Dass is sitting in the corner. He's meeting his guru. He's got his arm crossed, kind of angry and, you know, self-righteous in that moment. And Neem Karoli Baba says to him, "Oh, you were out last night thinking about your mother. She died of spleen." And spleen was the one word that he had said in English. And it just hit him like a lightning bolt. And Ram Dass remembers that time as the moment that he was most impressed by his psychic powers. Just how could he have known? I didn't tell anybody this. But then when he did look up at him, he just felt this immediate hit of unconditional love. And he had never, ever been looked at like that or loved like that. And in that instant, it just captured his heart. And, you know, he says, in my first meeting with Maharaji, he showed me his powers. He blew my mind that he knew about my mother and that I was thinking about her the night before. At that point, I was impressed with his mind reading. He blew my mind first so he could get the mind out of the way. But I realized that it was really his unconditional love that pulled me in. This helped me to see that I could accept myself as lovable, and my fear started to dissolve. I started to allow the truth of who I was. After that, all I wanted to do was share that love. And I think that was kind of his tipping point, yeah, in his life.
Now, he explains, or in the words in this book of his, Ram Dass explains, he defines the term guru. And this was, I know was important for me because I'm always uncomfortable with the idea of devotion to one teacher or one person. We have so many examples of spiritual gurus who have ended up being real abusers of their followers.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how Ram Dass sees the word guru, defines devotion. It's not really a devotion to a person, a personality. Is that right?
It's 100% correct. And Ram Dass felt very strongly. He always, you know, denied the term guru, that he did not recognize himself as a guru, but he did have a guru. And in the book, you'll notice in the back that he has kind of a caution on seeking false prophets and how to really understand when, you know, somebody is authentic in their teachings, and does warn against exactly what you're saying. But I love also that he is open to the guru, the teacher, as a method for helping you to come into union with yourself and to a higher power. But he says, you probably walked right by your guru. She may have stopped you and given you a traffic ticket. You probably didn't even give him a quarter when he was asking for a handout. The next true being of Buddha nature you meet may appear as a bus driver, a doctor, a weaver, an insurance salesperson, a musician, a chef, a teacher, or any of the thousands of roles that are required in a complex society. Do you think the guru is going to be someone with light streaming out wearing a sign that says, I'm your guru? When you're ready, you'll see your guru. And I think he just really wanted everybody to know that, yes, the guru is somebody who is like a perfect mirror for yourself. You know, they don't have a lot of stuff. They don't have attachments. They don't have, you know, agendas. But you can also see this in other people, the reflection. And when he is listing all this, the insurance salesperson and the teacher and the bus driver, he is really identifying them as the soul. And I think that is what he's saying. He's saying, whatever you see as your true teacher, just know it's a reflection of who you also are. But he does go on to really say, use caution and use discernment and wise judgment, and know that that might change for you. At one point, you might have a teacher that you look towards as a guru, but it could change later in life.
And he also says that the guru is a doorway.
Mm-hmm. He says the guru is a doorway to God or to that higher self. And he says, and this is a teaching in India, that they say God, guru, and self are truly one. So he really spells out for us, you know, how to look for guidance, how to look for wise teachers, and how to access the doorway to our higher self through our soul.
You have a part in the book in which Ram Dass talks as if he has already died.
Mm-hmm.
Are these his words as well? Where did this come from?
Okay, I love this part. And so this actually came from his words before he died. So they were taken. He had a beautiful caregiver. Her name is Dasima. She lives on Maui. And Ram Dass lived on Maui, and he had a host of caregivers. And one of his caregivers was named Dasima. She cared for him for a long time. And so there are recorded lectures and interviews between him and Dasima. and between his caregivers. And so he really laid out what he wanted to happen when he died, when he took his last breath, what he wanted to happen to his body afterwards. So we took that section of the book from his words to them. And so that's where that comes from.
So for you and your twin sister, how has this book informed how you are going forward in your life? I mean, I would imagine to do a book like this, it's beautifully done. The illustrations are really gorgeous, and there's so much material in there that's so useful. What were some of the ways in which it might have changed you?
Well, thank you for this question, because I do think about this a lot, and it is kind of still evolving how it's showing us. You know, when we came to his teachings in 96, we were, you know, just graduating high school. And now we're parents of four beautiful kids, also going off to college. And so it's really a work in progress for us. His teachings in this book really inspired a fresh look on these teachings. You know, we thought we incorporated his teachings in a certain way all through our life. And when we worked on this book, we saw really how we've evolved, how our relationships to his teachings has evolved, being parents and trying to not really steer our kids, but give them a solid foundation and, you know, the importance of having a spiritual life and knowing that your spiritual journey is evolving has been really just kind of like we're also reminding ourselves of that too. So when we worked on this book, one of the biggest things for me was seeing how a creative practice is also very much my spiritual practice. And I didn't really recognize that for that as such a powerful practice. You know, you think your meditating or yoga or mindfulness practices are your spiritual practices, but for me, creativity and art was huge. And I also recognized how creative Ram Dass was too. So that was something that changed for me. You know, he was a cello player. He was a writer. He loved to chant. He was a poet. He spoke so beautifully. He had many creative practices. So just really connecting to creativity as a spiritual practice. And then also just being reminded, you know, we worked in the death and dying field for 2 decades or more, but really writing this out and writing his spiritual journey and just being reminded of how he worked with the dying, he worked with the dead, you know, speaking with the dead after they're gone. Just those were so powerful for me. So little glimpses throughout the book of practices and teachings that, you know, I had put aside or not really thought that they were so influential really came up for me as well.
Well, that's great. And this is just a wonderful book. You Are the Universe, Ram Dass Maps the Journey. Amy Butens, thank you so much for talking with us here, sharing this book with us on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been special. Thank you.
Amy Butens, go to writersvoice.net to see illustrations from You Are the Universe. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.